Okay, fine. It's under control here. And we're ready to go. Hello. Oh,
wait.
There we are. There. Everything's under control here now. Oh, speaking of being under control, have you become aware of a peculiar kind of underground that exists? A kind of underground of goofing off? A kind of underground of taking it easy and pushing things around and making it seem as if it's actually happening, whereas in actual fact, it's not occurring. We have here, Walt, do you have that thing, 50 great moments there? See, so the one that says 50 great moments there. Just get in there, Lee. There it is, 50 great moments, and you'll find one in there marked Chopin. I think Chopin, Lee, here, you help Walt. You take one of the discs there, and I'll fill there either Chopin or Humoresque will be all right. Just anything soft and sweet, because it describes the scene probably better in the more dynamic terms than I can describe. Oh, by the way, speaking of dynamic terms, I've just been approached by somebody to make a few comments before the fair opens on what I think the fair is going to be like. Well, what's that? Good, fine. Humoresque? What's that got to do with the fair, Walt? Although perhaps that might be close to it. I have a vague feeling that about the fair, that we're off to a really good start. This is the opening, you know, the opening blast, Robert Moses saying that the school kids got to pay full price and all that stuff. Somehow that's getting the fair off to a good 20th century mid 1960s attitude. The whole thing is starting to fit together. Yeah, have you ever wondered how New York ever got along without Moses? I wonder how it must have been. It must have been very confusing, you know, without somebody to tell you how things should be run and how things should be put together and all that. It's funny how the city just grew. It's amazing like that. Of course, there are men of destiny everywhere. And this reminds me of the kind of dynamic sort of stuff that you see are all around you now. For example, the score is tied. Just 5 seconds to go. You take a long, high, arching one-hander from behind your desk just as the buzzer sounds. It's a tense moment. The ball is dropping, slices off the backboard. Hits the rim, bounces around, and it's in! You've won! You've won! You've finally beaten your secretary! Executive waste basketball is the newest indoor sport of busy executives all around town. Backboard is genuine walnut-finished hand-rubbed wood, complete with a simulated gold-plated rim and rope net. Perfect size to fit all waste baskets. The ball, just crumble up any piece of paper, bills, memos, FYIs. They're all perfect for the game. The buzzer? Why, that's only the boss calling you on the intercom. Probably wants to challenge you to a game. Watch out. The word's out that he's got a deadly jump shot. Yes, you must be satisfied. Satisfaction guaranteed. Diners Club cards honored. Somehow that expresses so much about American business right there. The whole scene, the whole business of playing the game. Of course, I think one of the hardest things to do today in this world of total automation, and automation is becoming even part of the executive world. I don't think this has been really discussed much. When we think of automation, we think of people working machines somewhere, you know, operating great big drill presses and lathes and one thing another. But one of the sneaky sides to automation is the taking over of, you might say, editorial and executive prerogative. That almost any organization today has a great battery of research machines that do nothing but make research statements, or at least make research figures available, so that in the end the executive has, of course he likes this feeling too, has his hands tied. And so when they throw out the design by the artist, the engineer who's created this beautiful design, the executive says, "Well, actually, Reg, what can I do? We've taken an in-depth survey." As far as I'm concerned, the design is magnificent. Actually, I vote for it all the way. I'm going to put my name down for it all the way. But my hands are tied. All we can do is just, we've got to go along with it. Of course, then they wind up with the Edsel. What's the matter? Everybody looks so solemn. What's the matter? It's all right. If you're going to worry, you go out there and worry, huh? Oh, okay. Don't worry. I'm not afraid of him. He's afraid of me. Actually, that's the way it goes. The problem, of course, is one in which automation has taken over where the decision used to be made. You know, the decision was very important in an executive's world today, but no longer do you find many of them who actually make decisions. They are, in a sense, tools of the machine itself. Did you see that great article in the New York Times here the other day? It's so rare that you find somebody actually laying it out. Really laying it out about whatever happens to be happening today. It was on the front page of the Times, and I must give the Times credit for that. It was an interview, or at least a report, of a discussion. It wasn't really a discussion. It was a testimony that was being given before a congressional committee that was investigating the effects of automation on the population at large. Did you read that, Walt? Boy, was it ever a red-hot piece. And he was and is the president of a company, one of the big companies, that builds automation equipment. So he really knows what he's talking about. He builds this stuff, and he sells it, and he studies the situation all up and down the line. And he said one of the things that is holding us down is the great belief that many people in positions of power and writers and one thing and another, the myths that many of them hold about automation. One of the myths being, one, that automation will create more jobs. He said, forget it. If it was going to create more jobs, we wouldn't automate. He just said it right out there. He said, nobody. Then he said one of the other great myths is that there will be a large number of new types of jobs created, like maintenance men, people who are technicians and so on. He says, these machines practically need no maintenance. I'm sorry, he said. There will be no jobs. He says, if it created jobs for maintenance men, again, it would be impractical to have these machines. So it's a myth. He says, we want to believe it so badly, it kind of solves the problem for you, that we do believe it, and forget it. It's a myth. He says, furthermore, a lot of other myths about it is that we will reach the point of no return. He says, it is not foreseeable in the future. He said, and then he went on to say such things as, well, there are roughly 40,000 or more jobs a week that are being eliminated by automation. Now, he means these jobs are eliminated. He doesn't mean that men are being misplaced. He just means displaced. He just means that there won't be those jobs, period. And yet our population is going up. And so as 40,000 jobs go out, and he says, oh, one more thing. He says the curve will rise. He says there will be more than 40,000 when automation really begins to swing, until finally probably 200,000 and 300,000 a year will be eliminated totally. Those jobs will no longer exist. And he says, we just better decide about that. So at the bottom of the page where this article finished, in sort of an ironical juxtaposition of pieces, often you'll find this in a newspaper where you'll find two or three pieces clustered together that presents a kind of strange cross-section of the world. Sometimes it's deliberate, other times it's just inadvertent that they're there. Well, this piece, underneath it, under the end of this piece, had a piece about the first UNIVAC has just been retired. And they were retiring it. It was in the Treasury Department. And the UNIVAC typed out a message. It said that it was now processing its last piece of data. Good night. Cut itself off. And they all stood around, and the Treasury officials, after 10 years, didn't know whether to give it a watch or what. It was now done. It had done something like 730,000 hours of work. and typed 87 billion words and figured out 67 trillion equations and done all this fantastic stuff and built the pyramids by itself. And now they are sending it to the Smithsonian. It's UNIVAC 1 has been put to rest. And the reason it's been put to rest is because UNIVAC 1, the way the article put it, is now a moron compared to the other ones that are coming on who can do like 10,000 times more than this one. And so he has been put to rest in the Smithsonian Institute. And I suspect eventually there will be two or three people on display in the Smithsonian Institute, also outmoded, of course. Now, the problem... this is WORAMNFM New Yorkie here. And so in the end, you find these things like executive waste basketball going on. That's a little telltale piece of truth where guys are sitting around in their office trying to figure out waste. Can you imagine Scrooge, Ebenezer Scrooge, with a game of waste basketball? There, and Bob Cratchit and he are trying to see who can throw the memo in from the corner, you know, with the over-the-shoulder shot. And Scrooge is working on a jump-push shot. And old Ebenezer and Tiny Tim comes in on his crutch and tries a bounce shot, you know. Well, of course, in those days, there was a different problem there. It was quite the opposite. There was more work than anybody could do. And now today, there's less work than anybody can do. And so the problem has become one of great complexity now. And eventually, they predict, there will be a day when man will be given over to total leisure. Now, that sounds like a great idea. It does. It only sounds like a great idea to people who are working their ears off, you know, who are really sweating like mad. The idea of total leisure sounds great. But a guy who hasn't done a lick of work in 9 years, total leisure doesn't sound very great to him, really. In the end, it's one gigantic piece of boredom. So we begin to have all sorts of little examples of triviality beginning to grape. One of the things about people who are becoming bored and who have very little to do in their lives is a great attention to trivialities. Have you ever seen an old grandma who has not had anything to do for years, how much attention she will spend fixing the wax artificial flowers? You can see that in places. One of the sad sights is to go into the H&H or any one of the all-night restaurants here in town and see old ladies who have looked forward all day to their one big moment of going out where they have this one thing which is going to become important to them, and that's to eat. That's the one thing that they have done constructively all day. And so they will come in, and have you ever watched them? I watched a couple of old ladies here a few months ago go over and look over all the things, the pie and everything, and they walked back and forth, and they went over and they got their change, and they counted their nickels. And then they walked back and forth again, and then they went over and they looked over the forks and the knives and the spoons, Ed, and they looked at all, and they finally picked the knife they wanted and the spoon they wanted, and then they went back and they looked again, and they got a good tray, and they picked up some paper napkins, and oh, it was just a tremendous deal, and it took them about 25 minutes to even get to a slot, much less make a selection. Well, then they started to make selections, and between every selection, they would talk it over. Emily would discuss the squash, and Clara would hold out for the carrots. And then they would both decide, no, the corn on the cob looks very good tonight. And they would go over and look at the corn on the cob, and they would talk to the person behind the counter. This would go on and on and on. Then they would get to the meat place, and they would go back and forth, and they would look at the sliced lamb, and then they would look at the fried chicken, then they would look at the fish, and they keep going back and forth. All the while, the real eaters behind them are really getting bugged, you know, going around, all right, come on, get out of the way there, and they're moving on. You know, the guys with 9 minutes to get their whole lunch in, and they're yelling, and Emily and Clara are spending their whole, this is their whole day, really, you know, and they finally get through the line, and they've got their stuff, and they get to the end where the cash register is, and then they talk to the lady there. They give her the dollar, and the lady makes the change, and there's a little discussion, and then they finally move on through, and then they go out and they get themselves some coffee, and they come over, and that is when it really starts, is when they sit down to the table. And this is, it happened to be that they were at my tables, I happened to notice them. They sit down at the table, and each one of them takes a little paper napkin and spreads it out like a doily in front of her, you know, just spreads it out very carefully and puts her little fork over here and her little knife over here. And she puts a little spoon down here, and then takes a handkerchief or something out, one of those little pink things, you know, with flowers on it, and begins to polish the knife. She polishes the knife and polishes the fork, and all the while the food is sitting there. And then she takes her dish and her plate and puts it right in the middle there. And then she takes the sugar and very carefully puts it into the coffee and stirs. And all the while, Emily and Clara are talking about the beans. They're talking about the corn. And then they talk. Oh, she said, oh, for heaven's sakes, I'm just so sorry. I didn't see that whole wheat bread. And then they talk about that. They haven't even eaten yet, you see. And by this time, they've been in this place for about an hour, maybe pushing an hour and a half. And eventually, they start to very, very slowly pick at the food very carefully, because they've got to make this last another hour. Eating it is a very major thing. And then after they have eaten the food, then begins the big discussion about dessert. This is another whole half hour, three quarters, maybe perhaps even an hour. There's a lot of discussion going on there. And that after, and yet it goes on so placidly. You've seen this happen, Ed. You've been in these. It goes on so placidly, and it is the attention to the triviality that marks the emancipated person. And when I say emancipated, I mean the person who has been relieved for one reason or another from life. You don't have to be involved in life, so now you can fool around with all this little trivial stuff like tatting and, you know, and polishing apples and all that kind of stuff. And it takes many forms. Ed, do you have my sweet little music there? Here's another advertisement that shows the same syndrome. Only at ANS in all of New York. New Pet Pampering Dog Cosmetics by Poodaloo. Dog perfume, Arf Pet, 2 ounces, $2.50. Le Chien, 2 ounces, $2.50. And this is a darling little item for the decline and fall division of the Roman Empire Department. Masketeer Doggy Mascara. Yes, mascara for that lovely little French poodle of yours. Just $1.75, and it comes in several fetching shades. Nail enamel, made just for little doggies. Many bright shades to choose from, beginning at $1. Shampoo concentrate for the perfect doggy do. Complete with self-applicator, although we don't quite know how the little doggie's going to apply it herself. Or himself. But nevertheless, it comes with a self-applicator. 12 ounces makes up to 48 ounces of lovely Doggy Do shampoo. Just $1.98. Yes, friends, fellow Romans, now for the first time you can pamper your lovely pet with cosmetics, especially blended to make them look even more beautiful. Come in and write or phone for these beauty aids for your lovely little pet. Ta 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 ta. That's very good. That's it. Now you hold that one. You just keep that one on there. That's a good one for this scene. Now I ask you. I wonder whether you will find four or five guys living in the frontier somewhere, hacking away at the underbrush, interested in doggy do shampoo. Or mascara for that friendly little sheepdog of yours that's out there yelling at the sheep. Well, this is a you know, this is all part of the scene. You know, it's all part of the business where people no longer have any involvement with life, and you can totally involve yourself in the trivialities, the little things which, you know, don't matter. There's no responsibility whether your dog's mascara is running. Or whether or not you've just scored a two-pointer from over by the water cooler there, you know, a big bounce shot with your executive wastebasket basketball set. Now here's of course it takes many forms. Now when the machine itself, even the machine, you know, has a tendency to become in a totally well, I suppose you might say frivolous civilization, and it's certainly not the American civilization I'm not talking about. I'm talking about the total machine civilization, wherever it might occur. This is happening in other places in the world. That the machine itself, like dogs, begins to have elements of total uselessness. The dog really, in many areas today, is no longer an animal at all. It's a piece of jewelry, some kind of cosmetic that you carry with you. It's some kind of a strange, live extension of something you never were. I notice fat ladies often have skinny dogs, and that gives them a feeling of being skinny. Little thin males have gigantic Great Danes. That's a new thing. Have you noticed that? Little thin people walking around, and they have dogs that are 17 feet tall. So you can achieve through your pet what you yourself never were. I'm looking for the day when the little thin people wind up with gigantic, enormous mastiffs. You know, the kind with the stainless steel collars with spikes on them. You know, that kind with the big phosphorescent teeth. Oh, yeah, they've got them there. The Hound of the Baskervilles is just around the corner. I can hear them baying now on Lexington Avenue in the 50s. Well, these things, the day will come, of course, when the machine itself will begin to have elements of uselessness. Here is an example of that now, which probably you haven't run into yet, but you are about to. It's about to burst on the American public. Real quiet there, and then just a suggestion of the decadence there. Do you remember the days when you used to think a car was for going around places, you know, bumping into things and yelling out of the window of? Well, it's taken on a new dimension. We have now his and hers transmissions for the new car. Now for the man who really wants to drive his car and keep his automatic-minded wife happy too, add the Hurst dual-gate transmission control. His gate, his transmission, gives a rapid, positive, masculine 1-2-3 shift. Hers has the familiar, soft, automatic setup. He gets all the hard-hitting, high-performance capability the transmission offers, while she retains all the convenience of an automatic driving gear. It makes driving fun again, men, and adds individualism to your car, yet keeps it safe and easy for mom and the girls to drive. A simple flip of a latch locks the competition gate to all but the lucky masculine key holder, and that key, men, can belong to you. His and hers transmissions. So with a flip of the switch, the car can become masculine. I bet a lot of people wish they were like that. But it's all happening all around the line. And we're trying to take a brief gull's eye. Oh, speaking of cars, you got that thing in there, Eddie? All righty. Righty-ro. Hit it.
Wouldn't you really rather have a Buick?
A Buick.
A Buick.
A Buick.
A Buick.
A Buick.
Wouldn't you really rather have a Buick?
A Buick.
Than any other kind of car?
Yes.
In 1964... the car for lovers and car lovers is the romantic new Buick Skylark. You'll love how it gets you away from the crowd in a hurry. This year, you can practically custom make your own Skylark with a choice of three new engines, one gas miserly V6 and two V8s. And there's a new Super Turbine 300 transmission. It's a very personal car for very particular people.
Of course.
And above all, it's a Buick.
There won't be over 2 million other guys.
So, wouldn't you really rather have a Buick? A Buick? A Buick? Oh, look at you
rather
have a Buick this year.
I like it. Miserly. Turbo prop, 6,000 horsepower, V8 Jetstream engine. Miserly. I know a guy who's just got himself tapped right into the little big inch pipeline. He didn't even bother. He's got a big flexible pipe. Just sucks it up there. It's funny. You know, along the line of that, how people get, how we're slowly becoming pretty much, I suppose you might say, superfluous, is perhaps reflected in the way we approach real problems today. That it was very difficult, you know, for a Roman when Rome was really sliding down the ways, going into the deep water. It was very difficult for a Roman to ever actually get involved, to ever really get worked up or excited over anything that was being reported from the front. You know, there was the guys come running back all the way from Sparta or from someplace, all out of breath and arrows sticking out of their back. And there was, oh, come on, you know, what is, sit down here and have a ham hock and have some grape, and the girls will be in a minute, and we'll have a swim in the pool, and we'll get on to the baths. And it was very hard to get anybody to get excited over anything. And when they did, they preferred to sing a song about it. They preferred to make it into a little playlet, which they all acted out. Well, this is pretty much what's happening in our world today. You know, the real elements that are the real problems of our world, the racial problems, so on, have all become prime showbiz themes. They really have. And they've become themes in such a way as to nullify their actual, to blunt their actual impact, what they really are about. This is an old story. If you can get people to sing about it, they're not going to worry about it. Even though the singing seems to be a form of worrying, it rarely is. Music is always a substitute for thinking. And once you can get that going, you're all set. You're all right. Now here's just a little thing that was sent to me, that picked it up, and it's a very official piece of business here. This is not printed in one of those little Reader's Digest funny things at the bottom. This is from a newsletter by a big electronic company that builds transistors, and they make resistors and one thing and another. They're really a hard-hitting outfit. And here is another one of the little pieces that I thought you might... you could see just a glimpse of how much man is beginning to mean in his own world. Just a little tiny glimpse, just a little glimpse, that's all. It's just like a little mosaic, but you can once in a while feel worlds to come. A new device stops machine tools when sharply spoken words such as, "Ouch!" are uttered by an operator. The device is not sensitive to ordinary background noises, but responds to any sharp, exclamatory remark, particularly of the "Help!" variety. Boy, somehow the idea of a machine that only responds to people screaming. Now, that on the surface, that sounds kind of nice. You know, a machine stops when a guy goes, "Oh, my foot, oh!" And the machine stops. Well, let's look at it another way. I mean, how did the machine get to the point where the guy couldn't control it and reached out and grabbed his foot? And he had no control, obviously, over the thing, except to scream at it. And all along the line, you see these little elements of creeping non-peopleism. Now, I'm sure that we have created this enormous machine, this great wind-up world of ours. Have you ever had the feeling that the world someday, eventually, is going to have a giant key sticking out of somewhere near the pole? And it'll be wound up magnetically or something, and it'll just continue to run and run and run. You know, there have been theories that eventually, when man does really become totally outmoded, that the machines that he's created will continue to run on and on and on long after he is a fossil, a fossilized form. And, of course, the machines that we have today can easily evolve into other forms. It could very well be, you know, that we're the missing link. We like to think that man is the final statement on this earth by God or whatever it is that you prefer to believe in. It could very well be UNIVAC 1 is Adam. Has it ever occurred to you? And that we have been just those things swinging in the trees comparatively up to this point. Now, I'm quite convinced that when there was evolution, you know, when evolution was really, was of course, it takes billions and millions and millions of years, but evolution at its peak, when forms of life were changing over the great millennia, it must have been that an earlier form would look upon a new form as a lesser form rather than a higher form. That here you had a great reptile, a brontosaurus, for example, walking around scratching and eating trees, and knocking down mountains and everything else. That the first scurrying little four-legged creatures that walked on their back legs and had this funny look in the eye must have looked like just lice to him, you know, little nothing things. He'd kick them around. But nevertheless, there was the genesis of Ed Sullivan and other great things to follow. It must be that way. So right now, we all feel superior to the machine. Have you noticed that there's all kinds of writings that, well, actually, the machine is the product of man's mind, and as such can never outdo man, and not really, that it's dependent upon blah, 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 et cetera, blah, blah, blah. Well, I don't know. There's no way of knowing what it'll be like 500 years from now, or 1,000, or 1,500 years from now. Looking at it over the long sweep of history, have you ever had the feeling of real curiosity now that we have had a glimpse of the world to come, the brave new world, a feeling of real curiosity about, let's say, the world of 2,000 years from now and man's status in that world? I'll bet a man of today would be totally incomprehensible to men of that time. Like, for example, insisting on being called by your name. I'll bet that concept is going to disappear. You know, we like to think that names always were. They weren't, you know. That the name is not really a very old tradition. That only a few thousand years ago, men were not really called names, but they were just known by the trade that they followed. A carpenter or a mason, the sailor. They were just called by that, and they would give them a little first, like big sailor, or short sailor, or big mason, or fat carpenter, that kind of thing. Yeah, sure, that was really sure. And then they would say fat carpenter's son, and that would be the next guy. Yeah, nobody had names like Charlie Brown or Eddie Zajac. That kind of stuff. That's a useless name. And that's right. They didn't have names like that. Well, eventually, I suspect that we will go back to that same system. That, like the zip code, will do away with states eventually. Yeah. The zip code is going to do all that jazz about states and all that stuff. That's going to go, believe me, eventually. For all practical intents and purposes. Now, it is. If you were to go into the post office, you will find that such things as states and names of cities and places like that are practically out of date. They just don't do that anymore. With the zip codes and all that coming in, and the future projected ideas of mailing things, you'll never have to have anything like that. You know, you've seen names, for example, little names like telephone exchanges have disappeared now. The number is becoming the primary means of designation. And I will go further than that. I will say that eventually even the number will be meaningless. There will be a tape form punch. You will have a punch form that will be far more meaningful than the actual number that the punch form stands for. Have you ever looked at the little bottom of your check? Now, the number doesn't mean a great deal. It's the way those little holes are in the check that actually makes the difference to the machine. Nobody really looks at that number. It's the machine that scans those holes that makes the decision as to whether this check bounces or not, whether your account will balance or whether it doesn't. And it's the way the holes line up. And probably 1,000 years from now, guys won't have numbers, really. We like to think of people having numbers. I don't think they'll even have that dignity. I think that they will have some form of punch thing which they will use constantly to relate to one another. Now, whether they will relate to one another ever individually in the end, I doubt. I suspect that man will be able to get along with very well without man himself, which will mean that each one of us will be sealed in some kind of a compartment. And any conversations or any relationships we have with other people will be through largely electronic means. You know, this is beginning to happen in many marriages. I know of several marriages right here in town where people live in separate apartments. And they see each other occasionally. Now, that seems pretty wild, but this is nevertheless true. And, I mean, like in the same block, they live in a apartment. It's not people who work on one coast and somebody works in another city. I don't mean that. I mean people who literally have found that they live with their friend, their wives, or whoever it might be, better away from them. And so yeah, they may, once in a while, they'll get together over the phone. And guy said a remarkable thing here the other day to me. He said, on the phone, he says, I understand my wife's had the pip lately. Of course, I'm at the other apartment. I haven't seen her, but I understand she's had the pip. I said, what? And they weren't separated either. Remember that. They got along fine, get along great. They just find that life is better separate. And so when you carry this trend, that the satirist or the writer must always take the trend and carry it forward as far as he can carry it. And see what is going on in the time and the place where he lives, and to project it to another place or another time. Now, one of the things that we fool around a great deal with when people are beginning to get itchy, get the triviality bug, is we fool with time and space. Since we have practically defeated space now, as far as getting to London, you can get to London quicker than you can get to Des Moines. You can, and literally, I mean that as a fact. You can. You can take off at Idlewild within an hour from now. You can take off from Idlewild and actually be in London quicker than you can get in Des Moines. Now you think you can probably the first impression, oh no, that's ridiculous. But have you ever tried to get from the airport outside of Des Moines to Des Moines? Well, the time that it takes you to get from the airport that is near Des Moines to Des Moines itself proper is roughly the time that would take you to get from London all the way into Brussels and possibly halfway to Prague. And so time and space doesn't mean much. Now they're fooling around with time. Here I think is something that indicates also and is part of that dynamic galvanizing thing. I remember when I was a kid and they would talk in class about the decline and fall of civilizations. It was very hard to understand what they meant by Nero fiddling while Rome burned. You always had a picture, a very literal picture, of this guy wearing this nightgown with some leaves in his hair, and he's standing there and he's somehow playing a fiddle, and you can see the city is burning there. Well, it was very, very hard to understand that in other than literal terms, actual literal terms, like he fiddled while Rome burned. You could see it burning. Well, then reading on a little further, you found that there was a great vanity that began to grow among the people of the period. Have you read about that? The vanity, that the people were so concerned with their personal appearance that it became a major occupation with those who existed at the time, a major occupation. Now here, you got a little of that in there, Eddie? This is another example of the thing.
From the New York Daily News, fellows, I think that all of you are going to be interested in this little handy tip here. That Madison Avenue executive you just met might be a lot younger than he looks. Jessica Russell Gaver will report in a forthcoming issue of Escapade that young executives are acquiring a mature, graying look by having their hair colored with such lovely rinses, fellows, as Silver Lining, Platinum, or True Steel. Madam.
Of course, it used to be quite the opposite. When guys would start getting gray, they would have their hair dyed something else. But now it's quite it's quite the opposite. Well, that whole thing of becoming involved in yourself to the exclusion of almost everything else in the world is evidenced now today in politics. You'll find this is becoming even a political viewpoint. Ayn Rand, there are other people who have been saying this politically and otherwise, that the chief concern is yourself. Anything that is important to you is important, and must be considered totally, in a way, the answer, the end-all, and the be-all of the way that a man lives in this time and place. Of course, that leads to a new kind of barbarism. It leads to all sorts of interesting repercussions, but who knows yet? You know, who knows? In 2,000 years, well, 2,000 years, I don't know. That even to this day, right now at this moment, if you'll notice, all over the dials, radio, television, even the movies, certainly the plays, novels too. Novels are becoming, and movies and plays, one thing or another, are becoming almost totally narcissistic, where the star who's in the play, who's in the movie, who's in the picture, is far more important than what is being said. We've come now to the point where directors are making pictures about directors making pictures. Fellini makes a picture about himself making a picture, and that becomes enough. That's the end of it all there. I feel that eventually, of course, the great stars will be director, photographer, writer. They will be all. They will just be in front of that camera for 2.5 solid hours, pulsating, and we will switch ourselves into them to feel their great waves of emotion and passion, and we will finally arrive at Aldous Huxley's feelies. We're pretty close to the feelies now. We're getting there, although they're not quite electronic yet. We have that one last step to make, that one faltering move, and we will have finally plugged ourselves right into Jonas Mekas's quivering psyche, or Fellini's vast naval contemplation inside of himself. It's not quite the same as Melville contemplating his flight towards that great white whale. Not quite the same thing. But then again, this is 1963. Dynamic, hard-hitting, ever-expanding universe, etc.
On WOR-TV, your Saturday...